which has passed with bipartisan support for 60 straight years. It sets the spending for military and includes provisions like troop raises and benefits. But Trump had issues with it because, one, he wanted it to end legal protections for social media companies. He also opposed the bills calling for the renaming of military facilities named after Confederate figures. Trump did indeed veto the bill, but Congress kind of had this planned out, and they set up these end-of-the-year sessions to try to override them.
Okay, so what's going to happen with that in the Senate?
Well, the Senate is controlled by Republicans, but it's considered likely members will also override the veto as well. Senator Jim Inhofe, an Oklahoma Republican and a Trump ally, said he's confident an override would work. I mean, frankly, there is no question the Senate has the votes to do so, but Republicans have proven over and over again that they don't like to go against Trump. And this would be a rebuke. If Republicans split from him, it would actually be the first congressional override of a President Trump veto.
Just as the presidency is winding down. Well, let me ask you about the incoming president, President-elect Joe Biden. He slammed President Trump and his administration yesterday for obstructing the transition to power.
Yes, he did. He spoke to reporters and publicly after meeting with his national security and foreign policy advisors. He talked about his goals, but he also criticized the Trump administration for holding critical information back from his own team.
We have encountered roadblocks from the political leadership at the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget. Right now, we just aren't getting all the information that we need for the ongoing, outgoing administration in key national security areas. It's nothing short, in my view, of irresponsibility.
You know, and this is not the first time that Biden has made such accusations against the Trump administration.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez for us this morning. Franco, thank you as always.
Hey, David, thank you as always. It's been an honor working with you and listening
to you. Likewise. Thank you.
As President Trump's time in office draws to a close, his administration has accelerated the pace of federal executions. Some Democrats want to see the incoming Biden administration take steps to end the practice altogether. But that's not something a president can do alone, NPR's Juana Summers reports.
Earlier this year, the Trump administration ended a stretch of nearly two decades without any federal executions.
The Justice Department has announced that it will resume the federal death penalty. This
is two black men, Brandon Bernard and Alfred Bourgeois, were executed in the last 2 days
by lethal injection last night. It was the first execution in 130 years at a federal prison during a presidential lame duck period.
Some of those executions have been scheduled for the administration's final days, before President Trump, who is a strong supporter of capital punishment, is replaced by President-elect Biden, who opposes it.
There have never been so many executions scheduled for so late in a presidency during any transition period in the entire history of the United States.
That was Robert Dunham, the executive director of the nonpartisan Death Penalty Information Center. He says that the U.S. government has not had multiple federal executions during a presidential transition since the late 1800s. Former Attorney General William Barr, who recently left the Justice Department, has said that the government is carrying out justice for, quote, staggeringly brutal murders. Critics of President Trump have denounced the decision to resume executions during an election year as politically motivated, and opponents of capital punishment are focused on what Biden can do when he takes office.
He says he opposes the death penalty, so we want him to use his clemency power and end this cruelty once and for all.
That's Representative-elect Cori Bush of Missouri, a Democrat who will take office next week. Bush has publicly called on Biden to not just commit to a moratorium on the death penalty. She wants him to grant clemency to every person currently on death row. She says a moratorium is a good first step, but it doesn't go far enough because it just staves off a decision until the next administration. President Obama did not use his clemency powers widely to commute federal death sentences to life terms. If he had, death penalty opponents say the people currently facing execution would no longer be on death row.
After 4 years or 8 years, however long President Joe Biden is in his seat, we don't want the next person to then come in and to be able to do what the Trump administration is currently doing.
Bush is one of a group of lawmakers led by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, who wrote to Biden calling on him to address the death penalty quickly after taking office. The letter calls capital punishment unjust, racist, and defective, and argues that the Trump administration has weaponized the death penalty. Biden's team has said that he plans to work to pass legislation to eliminate the death penalty at the federal level, and that he will incentivize states to follow the federal government's example. He has not said whether he would consider commuting the sentences of every person on death row. If Biden does pursue ending the federal death penalty, he won't be able to do that alone. He'd need Congress or a Supreme Court ruling. Here's Robert Dunham.
It's clear with the current composition of the U.S. Supreme Court that that's not going to happen. So the only way that a Biden administration would be able to end the federal death penalty would be to have some sort of bipartisan support in Congress.
While support for the death penalty is declining nationally, the level of bipartisan support needed in Congress may be hard to find. The institution is incredibly polarized, and unless Democrats win two runoff elections in Georgia, Republicans will hold control of the Senate. And even if they do win, Democrats will have a slim majority in the House. Here's Representative-elect Bush again.
My hand is raised. The hands of my team are raised. We will help do the work. If he will call on me, if he will call on Rep. Ayanna Pressley and so many others, we will help do the work. Like, put us in, coach.
Bush says she's hopeful that there's enough support on Capitol Hill to end the practice for good, but that it will mean that Biden must use his bully pulpit alongside organizers on the ground to convince the public that it is an urgent issue worth addressing now. Juana Summers, NPR News.
Well, the new year is 2 days away, and it can't come fast enough for so many of us. 2020, in so many ways, was rough.
So we asked listeners to share with us what got them through this year. Some of you reconnected with old friends. Several of you found a way to connect with strangers.
I've made a lot of new friends in 2020. People that I normally wouldn't meet, even in a non-pandemic year.
That is Erin Kuster from Tipton, Iowa. She liked to travel and often kept postcards to remember the places she had been.
I just looked at my postcard box this year and was like, yeah, I think it would bring people more joy to exchange these than to have them just like sitting in my office.
Kuster joined a postcard exchange. She says postcard writing is an art, a short and sweet way to connect.
I think about all these people who used to like write letters as their primary form of communication once upon a time before the internet. And I'm like, wow, they must have dedicated so much time to just sitting down and writing letters out to people.
During the pandemic, she has sent out around 300 postcards to people in the UK, Spain, Japan, China, and also here in the States. That connection has created new friendships.
Sahil Swali from Albany, New York, also wanted to help people feel connected. He created Write to Appreciate. It's an online program that gets people to write letters or even draw pictures for seniors living in long-term care communities.
Many of these elderly residents have been separated from loved ones during this pandemic.
So the idea popped in my head, how can we make them feel less lonely and less isolated?
60 homes now receive letters from Swelly's project.
One of the residents had loved the letters so much that she had actually pulled them off of whatever bulletin board or how the facility was displaying them, and she took them to her room and started putting them on her own wall.
Swali says he learned something about himself through his efforts.
Even if you're quiet, shy, and introverted, what you can do just with a little effort, with little courage, and a willingness to take risks.
The voices of Sahil Swali and Erin Kuster describing how they made it through 2020.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19 right now, and you're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear about the runoff in Georgia. Early voting has been underway for weeks, and there are signs that turnout will be high ahead of next month's Senate runoff elections that will determine which party controls that chamber. More coming up in 15 minutes.
We get it. You're busy, but you still want to stay informed and entertained at home, at work, and on the road. WPR is a great way to stay connected throughout your day. And with our new skill for Amazon smart speakers, you can ask for us by name. It's easy to install. Find the instructions online at WPR.org/speaker.
Support for WPR comes from the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, a resource for data collection and study design, serving the UW research community and the state through collaboration and innovation. uwsc.wisc.edu.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
When I get off the air today, I'm going to make sure that the snowblower is gassed up and that we'll actually start. We do have snow on the way. A winter storm warning will be in effect starting at 4 this afternoon for a large part of southern Wisconsin. Much of the rest of the state will be under a winter weather advisory starting at 8 tonight. A mix of sun and clouds today. Snow starts late in the day with the advisory area getting 3 to 5 inches of accumulation plus some freezing drizzle and 6 to 9 inches of snow possible in the warning area. Highs from the upper teens to the upper 20s. It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, committed to supporting ideas and institutions to advance education for all, preserve the environment, and promote vibrant performing arts. More information is available at hewlett.org. And from Merrill, Merrill Guided Investing helps manage a client's portfolio. MerrillEdge.com/investinggoals. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, both a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. There's been so much loss this past year. We've shared many stories of people who've died from COVID-19. But this week, we're talking with people who are grieving something that wasn't directly connected to the pandemic, but it sears nonetheless.
Hello, Erica?
Good morning. Yeah.
People like Erica Pullman. We reached her at her home in Solon, Iowa, and I had to start with an apology.
Okay. I'm sorry to be late. I'm finagling like children.
Oh, honey, I am hiding from my sleeping baby in the basement. There is no judgment from me.
Erica's son, Orion, is 14 months old.
14 months is running nonstop. Bowl of cat food in the toilet yesterday. Yep.
Erica is funny and thoughtful and vulnerable. This year, she experienced a deeply personal loss.
The greatest loss of 2020, I lost a baby on July 22nd of this year. You know, we weren't trying for another baby. My son was only 8 months old at the time. But that doesn't change the fact that I still built that space in my heart. You know that another baby is coming, and so you make the space and you make the room to love it, and you start making plans. Even if I didn't get a chance to share those plans with anybody before it was gone, you know, there are things that you have to start thinking about when you find out that you're pregnant. Little things like, am I going to be able to potty train my son before the baby is born? Or am I going to have two in diapers at the same time? It was small things. Mostly what I wanted to do, though, was just tell my husband so we could start making plans together.
But Erica didn't get a chance to tell her husband until it was too late. She was managing two hotels at the time, short-staffed because of the pandemic. There were only 48 hours between when she found out she was pregnant and when the miscarriage began, and she worked almost the entire time. When she realized she was losing her pregnancy, she called to tell her husband everything over the phone.
What he said to me was, "What do you need? What can I do?" And I honestly, I don't even remember what I said because there wasn't much he could do.
So that was in July. Where are you now in sort of navigating your grief?
It gets easier to manage. It gets easier to get through the day, to do the things that need to be done. Because I have news for you. A 14-month-old does not care how tired you are. 14-month-old does not care if you're sad. Your bills do not care if you're sad. There are still things that need to get done, but I still think about our baby every day. I would be about 6 months pregnant now if it hadn't happened. You know, we would be planning a baby shower, even if it had to be over Zoom. We would be getting all the new little baby clothes and washing them and folding them and just getting ready, but we're not. We're not, because there's nothing to get ready for.
What has it been like to go through this very intimate loss, this very personal loss, in the midst of this societal grief that we're all going through related to a once in a 100-year global pandemic? Have you thought about that? Does it connect you in a broader way, or does it make you feel even less connected because your grief isn't of that?
Honestly, it's a little bit of both. There are some ways that all grief is connected, I think, and there are some ways that everybody in the world, I think, is kind of feeling what we're feeling. You know, we just lost a very important woman in our family to COVID. But what you notice is that when you lose a friend, when you lose a family member, everybody else, there's a point of reference. There's other people who have memories of that person. There are memories, there are pictures, there are things that you can all share about that person that helps you feel more connected. And I think miscarriage is kind of a solitary loss to begin with. You know, nobody else has ever held that baby. No one has seen a picture of that baby. That baby has never smiled at anyone. There's nobody who has memories of that baby but me. There's nobody who ever held or carried that baby but me. And then to put that on top of not being able to see my friends, not being able to hug my parents, it's incredibly lonely.
Are you and your husband talking about trying to have another baby?
God, not anytime soon. If we ever do, and that is a big if. I made it through once. I made it to the other side once, but I can't do that again. I can't lose another baby. I can't.
We're approaching a new year. I know you all are getting ready to make a big move. Your husband got a new job. How are you looking into 2021?
I have to be honest, I'm just kind of hoping for a fresh start. I'm hoping to leave some of the heartache in 2020 and be able to look forward to being together. Look forward to making new memories as the family that we have, and it has to be better.
Well, I wish that for you and for all of us. Erica Pullman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
Finding an organ transplant can depend a lot on where you live, so new federal regulations are trying to level the playing field.
This is about understanding why certain areas are not performing well and seeing if we can fix them.
I'm Ilse Chang, tracking organ transplant disparities this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered, and you can hear it from 4 to 6:30 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and a news update is on the way, including a look at the question of whether pregnant women in Wisconsin should get vaccinated for the coronavirus. We'll have more on that and all the latest Wisconsin news after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The FBI is still investigating a motive for the Christmas Day bombing in downtown Nashville that wounded three people and damaged dozens of buildings. Authorities believe a 63-year-old Tennessee man, Anthony Quinn Warner, detonated the explosives in his RV parked outside an AT&T facility. The blast interrupted cell phone service and other electronic communications in several states. NPR's Hannah Alam is following the investigation.
Authorities have acknowledged that they're looking into the possibility that Warner was a believer in conspiracy theories related to 5G networks. That's usually paranoia about spying or baseless claims that say 5G technology is somehow causing COVID-related deaths. But in the absence of a public manifesto, what we do have is lots of speculation about motives and ideologies. But no conclusive answer. And this is a big multi-agency investigation. And we have to remember it's still only a few days old.
One of Warner's neighbors, Rick Loud, tells the Associated Press Warner told him a week before Christmas the world would never forget him. At the time, Loud says he didn't think much of Warner's remark. The House has voted to boost direct coronavirus relief payments from the federal government to $2,000. It's unclear if the Senate will do the same. Last week, Congress approved payments of up to $600 as part of a COVID-19 relief package. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Breastfeeding women were not eligible to participate in trials for the coronavirus vaccines that have emergency use authorization in the U.S. That means there's no data about the vaccine in that group. Still, Wisconsin's immunization program manager Stephanie Schauer says the vaccines are not thought to pose a risk for breastfeeding infants whose mothers get the shot.
And if a woman is part of the group that's recommended to receive vaccine, such as a healthcare worker, she may choose to be vaccinated if she is currently breastfeeding or lactating.
Researchers are studying the effects of the coronavirus vaccines in lactating women. Breastfeeding women routinely do receive other vaccines like the flu shot. People struggling with mental health issues in far northern Wisconsin often end up in the emergency room or experience long wait lists for services. That's according to a mix of healthcare, nonprofit, and law enforcement partners who are working to change crisis response. Danielle Kading has more.
North Country Independent Living received just under $500,000 this year to help reform mental health crisis response in Douglas County. The agency's assistant director, Liz Gilbertson, says a lack of resources can mean people don't receive services until they've reached a point of crisis. In those cases, people may be detained in an emergency if they're considered a harm to themselves or others.
If they're needing stabilization, a lot of times there isn't the local resources here, so they're having to go to further down in the state or other states to access and get those services.
That often ties up superior police officers who respond to calls for help. Gilbertson and community partners hope to provide more mental health resources to prevent people from reaching crisis and keep them closer to home. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin health officials reported 1,335 positive tests for the coronavirus yesterday. Of the people who got tested for COVID-19 over the past week, 24.6% were positive for the disease, according to DHS. That rate has been holding steady in recent days. The state continues to see a decline in new cases compared to the peak in November, but the spread of the virus remains high, with one in every 379 people in Wisconsin testing positive in the last week. The state reported 19 new deaths on Monday. 4,711 people in all have died from COVID-19 in Wisconsin. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt. Through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Los Angeles.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Culver City, California. We are a week away from two crucial Senate runoff elections in Georgia. The outcome will determine which party controls the Senate. And early voting has been underway for weeks. Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting has been covering both races and is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Stephen, people have been casting ballots for a few weeks now. So what can you tell us about the vote so far?
Well, more than 2.3 million Georgians have already voted in this election through early in-person voting or returning an absentee by mail ballot. That's pretty stunning for a runoff, which typically doesn't have that many people voting. But like you said, control of the U.S. Senate is on the line. Now, what we know is that these voters are slightly younger and slightly more diverse than what we saw in the general electorate. So that typically means that Democrats are ahead as of right now. And we look at the data of where people are voting, and most of these early votes are coming from metro Atlanta, suburban counties around the state, and in typical Democratic strongholds.
But how much can we really tell? Back in November, we really saw Democrats dominate the early and absentee vote, while Republicans turned out more on Election Day. So is that pattern repeating itself this time around?
Yes and no. We are seeing, you know, people voting at a similar pace that they were in the general election. But what's noticeable is who's not showing up to vote. I mean, Republicans do typically use Georgia's 3 weeks of early voting, but the numbers of Republican-leaning counties and rural strongholds are way down from what you would expect to see compared to some of the other counties. And so it's an uphill battle for Republicans to try to counteract all of the Democratic early votings, made more complicated by the holiday, where early voting is actually going to end a couple days early this time because of the new year.
Interesting, because Georgia has been the focal point for President Trump's baseless claims that the election was stolen from him. So how much is that impacting what voters are doing now?
It definitely has an impact, but it's hard to really quantify that because many of the people that have attended his rallies throughout the state and said that the system is rigged and that Trump should have won and that there's problems with our voting system are lining up to vote in these early voting sites. And so it's just really hard to square. But also, President Trump is holding a rally the night before the election in Northwest Georgia, the 14th congressional district, where Marjorie Taylor Greene is about to take office. She's leading the charge of trying to challenge election results. And that district has the lowest turnout of any congressional district in Georgia. And none of those things are coincidences.
That's Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting. He's been covering this closely for us. He also hosts the Battleground Ballot Box podcast. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
So this pandemic continues to disproportionately impact communities of color. In South Florida, a nonprofit is helping Latino and Black residents get access to COVID testing. They're also trying to build trust in the vaccine. From Everstation WLRN, Veronica Zaragovia reports.
A group called Healthy Little Havana received an assignment this summer. Convince residents of this neighborhood in Miami to get a COVID-19 test. The nonprofit has lots of outreach experience. It helped with the census counting. And because of the pandemic, it did that by phone. But this new challenge needs a face-to-face approach. At this apartment complex, three workers are knocking on every door. It's late in the afternoon and most people aren't home. Many have jobs in the service industry and also retail and construction. Elvis Mendez with Healthy Little Havana says some of them can't afford to stay home when they're sick.
People usually rather go to work than actually treat themselves because they have to pay rent, they have to pay school expenses, food.
This part of Miami is home to many Cuban exiles and immigrants from all over Latin America. Some people don't have insurance, others are undocumented. So Mendez and his team tell residents here about Ready Responders, paramedics who give free COVID-19 tests at home. One's immigration status doesn't matter.
Our mission is for all these people to get tested, regardless if they have a symptom or not, so we could diminish the level of people getting COVID-19.
One of the challenges of controlling the spread of COVID-19 is people who are infected don't always show symptoms. When the team knocked on Lisette Mejia's door, she had a baby in her arms.
No todas las personas tenemos el la habilidad del internet tan fácil.
She says not everybody has easy access to the internet to make an appointment for a test. They tell her about testing that weekend at a nearby school and give her cotton masks and say bye. Another neighbor, Gloria Carvajal, has anxiety about the deep nasal swab used in some tests. Outreach worker Maria Elena Gonzalez tells her it's really not bad. She's gotten lots of tests. The Health Foundation of South Florida has donated $1.5 million for this effort. Another part of the outreach happens here in Liberty City, a historically Black neighborhood.
Thousands upon thousands have died. So, Lord, we're saying today that we're not going to let their deaths be in vain.
Pastor Richard Dunn spoke at a memorial prayer service to honor Black residents who have died from COVID. Hundreds of white plastic tombstones filled a field behind him at a park. He's part of a new effort to build trust in the COVID-19 vaccines by holding online meetings with Black churches to hear directly from Black medical experts. The focus? Vaccines are vital.
Because of the fact that it's taken over 300,000 lives in the United States of America. And I believe to do nothing would be more of a tragedy than to at least try to do something to prevent it and to stop the spreading of the coronavirus.
Churches will play a big role. And that's why Dunn is so committed to doing his part. He knows it's a terrible disease. He caught it this past summer. For NPR News, I'm Veronica Saragovia in Miami.
And let's look ahead to All Things Considered later today. Transit agencies are struggling with lower ridership and revenues. So can subway and bus systems survive? You can listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, in about 9 minutes, you may want to have some tissues handy. Actually, I may want to have some tissues handy. It's the last day for Morning Edition co-host David Green. He's leaving Morning Edition, and coming up, the other co-hosts have a send-off for him as he takes on another opportunity. Stay tuned.
We can all make a difference and help stop the spread of COVID-19. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services urges all of us to wear a mask, wash our hands frequently, limit gatherings, and maintain social distance every time we go out. Working together, we can help save lives. Learn more about COVID safety, including information about the location of testing sites near you, at dhs.wisconsin.gov. Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, encouraging everyone, especially older adults, to protect themselves and others by getting a flu shot. More at wihealthyaging.org/flu.
Support comes from Gateway. The new semester begins January 19th. Although Student Services is closed through the holidays, browse the program catalog and register online now. Starting January 4th, career counselors will be available via phone, email, online chat, or Zoom.
This is
from the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar. The Matheson Memorial Library is launching a new online program just for adults entitled Master of Minutes via the Beanstack app. Registration begins on January 1st. Visit elkhorn.beanstack.org/reader365.
These insist all were willing to be relocated and no pressure was placed on them, but several human rights and activist groups say some were forced to go to the island, located 21 miles from the mainland. California is expected to extend strict stay-at-home orders today in areas where intensive care units are running out of beds. Governor Gavin Newsom warned residents to brace for the impact of surge upon surge from recent holiday travel. And next year's legislative session in Wisconsin will likely revive a debate over whether the state should accept federal funding to expand Medicaid. Details coming up in our newscast in 15 minutes. And there's always more news available on our website. You can see it at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Tens of thousands of Californians are still waiting for compensation. Fires that were caused by a local utility destroyed their homes and their businesses, and in some cases killed loved ones. For some of these families, the wait has been 5 years. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Lily Jamali reports on what's caused the delay.
This summer, Cheryl Maynard thought she saw light at the end of what had been a long and very dark tunnel. The utility PG&E was emerging from bankruptcy protection. It entered Chapter 11 after its equipment sparked the fire that burned down thousands of homes, including Maynard's, in the Northern California town of Paradise.
PG&E wildfire victims could not wait for the bankruptcy to end. It was long. It was exhausting. I mean, it was just a horrific process to go through on top of running for your life.
Today, Maynard is one of 80,000 survivors of several fires still waiting to get paid from a trust that PG&E funded as it left bankruptcy. So far, only 499 victims have received partial payments.
So here we are, 2 years later. We just thought our lives would be able to start on over again, and we're just heartbroken it hasn't happened.
One of the people running the Fire Victim Trust is Kathy Yanni.
We're very aware of the fact that due to COVID and economic conditions, that people really, really are in need of getting some money.
PG&E declined to be interviewed, but said in a statement that it's not involved with dispersing payments from the trust. Getting everyone fully compensated could take a while, says University of California Hastings bankruptcy law professor Jared Elias.
This is just a tremendously complex process.
That's in part because the trust needs to verify what people claim they lost. And also,
if you just push money out the door, it might mean that there wouldn't be enough money at the end to pay for the damages and the pain of the people who actually did suffer damages caused by PG&E's equipment.
And perhaps the biggest complication, it's not clear how much the trust is worth. In a rare outcome, even by bankruptcy standards, PG&E funded half of the trust not with cash, but with its own stock. The Fire Victim Trust now owns more than one-fifth of PG&E. That means on any given day, depending on the stock's price, the trust may be worth billions more or billions less. Other groups got cash settlements, including insurance companies and municipalities damaged by fire.
I'm very worried for the wildfire survivors being able to piece their lives back together.
Will Abrams lost his home in California's 2017 wine country fires. While many attorneys for survivors encouraged them to take the deal PG&E offered, Abrams opposed it. He says the trust owning stock means the future of fire survivors depends on shoring up the value of the company that hurt them.
If I'm being used as a bargaining chip for not pressing safety and security with PG&E, that's something that I am very uncomfortable with.
PG&E has said fire survivors voted overwhelmingly to approve the settlement they got. KQED's reporting found irregularities in the voting process, including ballots that victims received after a deadline set by the court. For now, the trust has yet to sell any stock, and it may be years before fire survivors know if they'll be made whole for all they lost. For NPR News, I'm Lily Jamali in San Francisco.
is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news from NPR and WPR just after 9. And then it's classical music with Peter Bryant sitting in for Stephanie Elkins.
There's a reason why being a good listener is so highly revered. Because it's hard. Morning Edition makes it easier for you to be a good listener by filtering out the background noise and focusing on what you need to know. We bring you the facts and news from all over and in your community. So practice good listening with Morning Edition from NPR News every day.
And thanks for listening to Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Wisconsin men's basketball team lost to Maryland 70-64 yesterday, snapping Wisconsin's 15-game home winning streak. The Bucks play the Miami Heat tonight. And a winter storm warning will be in effect starting at 4 this afternoon for a large part of southern Wisconsin. Much of the rest of the state will be under a winter weather advisory starting at 8 tonight. A mix of sun and clouds, snow starting late in the day, and the advisory area could see 3 to 5 inches of accumulation, plus some freezing drizzle. 6 to 9 inches are possible in the warning area, highs from the upper teens to upper 20s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. One of the voices who got us through 2020 is moving on. Our co-host David Green is on the air for his last day at NPR News.
Yeah, so people who meet NPR journalists for the first time sometimes say, oh, I hear you on the radio so much, I feel like I already know you. The thing is, the three of us do know David Green.
And the person we know in real life is very much like the one that you've met on the radio. He is determined. He is generous. He is thoughtful and absolutely committed to the truth.
So let's tell people a little bit about your time at NPR. David, you have been here for 15 years?
I think your math is correct. It's amazing. It has flown by, but yes, 15 years.
And you started out covering the White House as a White House correspondent.
Started at the top, veteran newspaper journalist. But I remember this, David. Radio was new to you, and you seemed to pick it up instantly. For the past decade or so, David has co-hosted this program, and he was brilliant from the beginning at the high wire act that is live broadcasting.
From NPR News, this is live special coverage. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're continuing to try to learn more about two suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing, one of whom was... David, I think you remember this day. Appalling story in 2013. And it was happening on a particular day at NPR News, the very day that we were supposed to be moving to a new building during the broadcast.
Yeah, we were closing down the building and moving to a new headquarters that day, and we the clock was set for noon for the satellite feed to go down and the building, the studio, to be completely shut down. But we had to stay live on the air. And so, if I remember, I think you jumped into a taxi cab at like 11:30, ran to the new building, got things going. I closed the broadcast in the old studio and said... good night, and rushed over and I think like asked the cab driver to go as quickly as possible, like in a movie, to get there and join you again in the studio to keep things going. That was extraordinary.
It's been hours now. The authorities continue to tell residents of Boston and the surrounding communities to stay in their homes, both to be safe.
David, I have to say, the thing that I love about you, the thing that has always impressed me, is that you're not just willing to go anywhere to cover a story. You actually want to go everywhere to cover stories. I know that in 2011, you volunteered to cover the uprising in Libya. The tough part of that was it was not that easy to get into or out of or around Libya. And there's this one piece of tape that you sent back that I remember so clearly.
This is one very locked down border. We're just crossed out of Tunisia to talk to the Libyan officials.
Salam.
Salam.
Is English okay or?
No.
A little?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. That was an intimidating hand wave, go away. Well, we were just refused at the Libyan border. The guards were, I guess, polite at first, but when we tried to ask too many questions, we got the stiff shoo away with a gun sort of motion towards us. And now it's back to Tunisia.
That's the stuff that usually just doesn't make it into the story, and I love that you put it on air.
Well, and no. I love that you brought it up. I mean, the other voice you heard there, we should just say, is our colleague Jim Wildman, whose idea was for me to just talk into a microphone in his shirt pocket. I mean, that is radio at its best.
In this work, we talk sometimes about range, which means, oh, that host or that reporter's ability to cover, say, the uprising in Libya, and sometimes even just days later, have a conversation with an author or a film director or a musician. And you do this so seamlessly, my friend. We hear you as a person. We hear your personality. We hear your vulnerability. You are so present in these conversations. And I'm thinking of one in particular. You know this is coming. I'm talking about your quality time with Barry Manilow.
Before I let you go, you wouldn't fulfill my bucket list and sing a bar or two of Mandy with me, would you?
With you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, ready?
And when you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away, oh Mandy.
Okay. Well, you're in tune.
You're very generous. Wow.
That was great.
That is the best. Were you hesitant at all in that moment, David? You're like,
yes, I was hesitant. I thought it was the most insane thing I ever did, but you convince yourself, like, okay, this is the one moment that could ever happen.
Yeah, not so hesitant that you didn't go.
And fair enough.
I think that's a theme for David Greene and how he's been as a colleague. Well, you came and you gave. Come on,
without
guys.
Without taking. And we're sending you away, oh.
That was really special.
That is the best send-off ever. Oh, my God. Can I say a thing? Am
no,
I allowed to say a thing?
No, because you're not done yet.
Living in your radio, how do you like me now?
David Greene loves karaoke. This was one of the songs that he used to perform when we would go out and do that together with big crowds. And as a parting gift, David.
Hey, David, this is Toby Keith. It's been great having you living in our radios. We sure are going to miss you and wish you all the very best. Keep on singing, buddy.
That is Toby Keith.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
No.
Well, now I'm speechless and tearing up a little bit. I'm going to miss you all so much. Thank you for this. Sitting here in a virtual room with the four of us, it makes me just want to remind people, like, all these moments and memories that we, our listeners here on the air. I mean, it's like there are so many people behind them who make this all happen. And I'm just so grateful for all of them. I'm so grateful to our listeners. I'm so grateful to the people whose stories we tell because they trust us and they're willing to be so vulnerable. And like at the end of the day, we're storytellers and we're listeners. And that's just so important. And I have learned from each of you so much in this job. And I've been so much better at this job by listening and watching all of you. And I just feel really lucky not just to have been colleagues, but to be friends with all of you. And that is going to be the case forever. So this is a great send-off. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
Now, we need to take a break, I think, to like dab the eye and so forth. So I guess we're going to do this one more time together.
Yeah.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Noel King.
I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Greene.
Still think I'm crazy standing here today. I couldn't make you love me, but I always dreamed about living in your radio. How do you like me now?
And you can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour for you, as well as news on our website at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9 now. The latest news is next, and then classical music.
Support for WPR comes from Sitka Salmon Shares, a community-supported fishery home delivering traceable wild Alaskan seafood. More about their small boat fleet at sitkasalmonshares.com/WPR.
Support comes from Gateway. The new semester begins January 19th. Although Student Services is closed through the holidays, browse the program catalog and register online now. Starting January 4th, career counselors will be available via phone, email, online chat, or Zoom. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and